So our current theme, you may not have even known we had a theme because we haven't really advertised it. But the last time the mentors got together, Dennis and Diane and I, to decide on the programs coming up and kind of how we would organize. And the last theme we had was around the suttas and suttas that speak to us, talking about favorite discourses of the historical Buddha that really touched us. And we could have done that for the next 20,000 years, right? There are a lot of them. But we kind of went for a while just doing popcorn, just our favorite, whatever occurred to us. And then we decided that our current theme would be inhabiting an uncertain world. So start thinking about this term, uncertain. And the way I'd like to frame it tonight, the title of this, rather than uncertainty and doubt, could have been uncertainty versus doubt. Because what I want to do is I actually want to lay out in this practice why uncertainty is a good thing. It's good not to be too certain about things. And then to contrast that with doubt, which can be disabling. And it's one of the five hindrances, right? It's the last one. So that's the overall framework. And uncertainty is not a comfortable place. And we have to acknowledge that in the beginning. That, I mean, what if I told you, well, I'll meet you at 5 o'clock, but I may meet you at 6 or I may not come at all. You know, that's not respectful. What if you're of a certain country, living in this country, and you have relatives back home in your home country, and you don't know if they can ever come visit you? Or, like, you're a professor, and you're maybe from a certain country, and you can't go to a conference because you don't know if you'll be able to get back in the country 2 weeks from now. Now, that level of uncertainty is really tough. You know, how about wedding vows, you know, if we say, well, in sickness and in health, unless I don't feel like it, until death do us part or sometime before then. You know, it just wouldn't work. So it's not a comfortable place, but this practice is not about comfort. I think any of you that have been meditating for any length of time at all know that this practice is not about comfort. It's about refuge. It's about finding a safe place to deal with, you know, the vicissitudes of our own lives and of the larger world. But it's not about comfort. But it's so it's not a bad thing. And the lens I'd like to look at that through primarily tonight is that acknowledging uncertainty acknowledges the way things are, because it ties directly into what we call the three characteristics in this lineage. We call the three characteristics, the three kind of abiding qualities of experience that are just the way things are, whether we like it or not. And if they're resisted, they cause suffering. So the first of these is impermanence. Uncertainty is real because of impermanence. That's the nature of things, to be impermanent. Wilma brought these beautiful flowers on Monday, and thank you to all the people that helped set up the room. It's really, really beautiful. And one of the things they do is that they bring flowers. Wilma brought these Monday for our beginning class, but they're still here. And they look beautiful as the day that she brought them. A month from now, they won't. I know that we're culling our Valentine's Day flowers at home and sort of tossing them out one by one as they fade and die. And you may have noticed, they're completely gone now. The ones that had the yellow ones back there, that had the spiky petals. I don't know what you call those. Freesia. Huh?
Freesia.
Yeah. They were just falling all over the place and getting down on the ground and things like that. Now they're completely gone. So we put these here on purpose. That's why we have flowers. I mean, we have flowers out of respect to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. But the reason we use flowers and not, you know, something more permanent is because impermanence is such an essential understanding to even be able to do this practice. And I mean, one thing I like to say about that is that impermanence is what gives us hope. If we were all stuck with our own minds as they are today, why would we even be here, right? I mean, the whole reason we're here is that we have some kind of hope that this practice will actually help us make changes in our lives that will bring less suffering to ourselves and others. And if it weren't for impermanence, we couldn't do that. We would be stuck with the mind or the social status or the neuroses or whatever we were born with. So impermanence in that way is one of the most hopeful aspects of the practice. It actually allows for the possibility that we can change. So the second characteristic is sometimes called selflessness. I don't really like that term, because even the Buddha himself used terms that showed that he understood and respected the reality of this relative self, this body and this mind that is born and dies and all of that. So it's not selflessness. It's interesting that the retreat that I went on last fall for 6 weeks, we had five teachers. And every one of those teachers, I think they must have gotten together beforehand and decided, okay, we're all going to frame this anatta characteristic the same. They used out of control, lost out of control-ness for this characteristic. It's that idea that nobody's in charge. You know, I mean, I think sometimes when we are feeling less secure, we fall into this attitude that, well, if I could just take charge of my life, you've heard that in the literature of self-improvement, right? If I could just take charge of my life, then boy, everything would be just great. What a nightmare. If I was in charge of my life, making every single decision about every single thing that happens in my life, what a nightmare. I mean, that, first of all, it's impossible. But second of all, that's way too much responsibility. Maybe I'm just lazy. But, you know, deciding what the weather's going to be today and who's going to encounter me during the day and what they're going to say, and I can't do that. And because I can't do that, life has this element of being out of control, out of our control. We're not the ones that decide who is going to walk in the door next and encounter us in some way that we have no way of predicting. And we have no real control when we sit down and close our eyes over what thoughts show up in our heads. I mean, it's kind of a relief, right? To know that you're not responsible for all that stuff that's going on in there when you're trying to meditate. It's just one way of really being able to let go of that and not stress over, oh, my monkey mind is just so busy and blah, blah, is that to remember that you're not in charge of that. You aren't the one that decides what thoughts come flitting through the mind. You might have some degree of control of how long they stay there, because the more you resist them, the longer they're going to stay. The more you dive into the content of the thoughts rather than just stepping back and following the process, the longer they're going to stay. But you don't have any control over what shows up. So this whole out of controlness is a way of understanding the way things are. And we just got a little CD from IMS, where I did the retreat, Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts. And on that CD, Joseph Goldstein gives a daily meditation on this anatta characteristic, this characteristic of not-self or of out-of-controlness, of the unreliability of things. A way of understanding that in 9 minutes. So try this out. I've been doing it ever since they sent me this thing. So it has three parts. You meditate on each one of them for 3 minutes. So the first one is that you meditate on sound. So at the beginning of the meditation, I said, you know, notice the rustling in the room, notice the passing traffic or whatever in the neighborhood. You know, you can usually hear Folsom Boulevard. You can hear the trains when they come by, which for me is always a nice echo of the trains that used to come by over at the Friends Meeting House. But they're the light rail trains in this case. You can hear all that. To the degree you think that's a distraction for your practice, I'm really sorry. Because it's just the way things are. In this practice, nothing's a distraction. Everything's just an opportunity for awareness. So, sounds, completely out of our control. I mean, unless la, 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 you can do that and shut them out, but you can't determine what sound occurs. You are just a set of ears waiting for sound to happen, and a mind that is ready to register that sound when it hits a healthy ear. Completely out of our control. So just meditate on sound for 3 minutes, understanding that we have no control over that. And there's no one doing that. There is no self that's creating that sound. It's this multi-directional thing that just shows up because of the way things are. You know, a light rail train goes by and a dog barks and a child or kids this weekend, those of you that were here Saturday, there were kids playing over at the LDS church next door. And it was bouncing off here. So at times it sounded like they were over here and you'd go outside and you realize they were over there. They have no control over that. It's just the way things are. The fact that there's a concrete wall over there that made it sound like they were coming from over there. Okay. So no control at all. So that's the first one. Second one is you go to either, depending on where you are and what's alive for you in your life right now, you go to either sensations in the body or the contemplation of death, Maranasati. No control over either one of those. Now again, as we did in the meditation, when the sensation shows up in the body, you have choice about how to handle that. You can decide to be with it, you can decide to resist it, you can decide to suppress and ignore it. You can have a response or a reaction to that sensation in the body, but you don't have control over what shows up. It just shows up. And usually stays for a while, fades away. It's just the way bodies are. Chronic pain is a different thing, but again, you don't have control over that. You just have control over how you respond to it and how you're with it. Yes?
The problem is the identification with the choice to listen or to attend to the body. Like, that still feels like self.
Yes.
That is choosing.
Right. That's why I don't like to get, right now, that's exactly why right now I'm resonating to this framing of anatta as being out of controlness. Rather than worrying about is there a self, is there not a self, you know, that sort of philosophical question, I'm leaving that one aside for a while, and I'm going with this out of controlness thing and trying to get kind of a understanding in my body that yes, these things are all out of control. We're going to get to your question in a little bit, actually. But the point we're trying to make here is that the experiences that impinge on us are out of our control. And we need to understand that to fully let go. If we think we're in charge of all that, we've got problems. We're going to make problems for ourselves if we think that we're in charge of all that, of what impinges on us. So, reflecting on sensations in the body, just noticing them coming, going, you know, noticing that there's no self that's producing those. And then, of course, the reflection on death. You know, as we all know, we're all going to die. We're absolutely certain of that. Well, we should be certain of that, because it's going to happen. But none of us know when. Right? We don't know when. And so, it's one of life's huge uncertainties. And so to know that that's out of our control as well. And not to mention, you know, death in people around us. You know, people of a certain age always have at least one person that's just died, is dying, or will die soon. So just to understand that and get that really, I think, is a valuable practice. Diane is, you know, famously fond of teaching the contemplation on death, Maranasati, here, and has taught a couple of year live classes and things. So I think it's very alive in the Sangha. I'm not teaching anything new. I'm just saying it's a very interesting way of framing this whole characteristic of anatta. So that's the second one, is either sensations in the body or the contemplation on death. And then the third one is thoughts. Doing your meditation, thoughts show up. They fade away or not, depending on how sticky they are, how much emotional baggage comes along with them, where they show up in your body, how aware you are of your body. Then they move on. Something else shows up. No control over that. You know, I mean, you could choose to try to think about something, but even while you're thinking about that, something else is going to show up that's out of your control. And to understand that and not beat yourself up because this unhealthy thinking pattern that you've had for years still shows up, and understanding it's not your fault, is a really helpful thing. So those three minutes each, try it out. I've been doing it for the last couple months since I got this, since I received the instruction via modern technology from Joseph Goldstein, and check it out. Good way of understanding the three characteristics. And all of them involve some level of uncertainty. Okay? And the impermanence, the out of controlness. And then finally, the third one, which is dukkha, which, you know, is sometimes translated as suffering with a capital S. And what it really is its unsatisfactoriness. It's the fact that in this human life, it just seems like there are very few moments when we can just say, things as they are, isn't it wonderful? You know? And there are moments like that. But there is also a lot of moments that aren't like that. And so this third dukkha characteristic is really just to understand that the unsatisfactoriness is not your fault. You know, it's not, things aren't feeling unsatisfactory because you didn't spend enough money last week on whatever products were being peddled to you as being the ultimate answer to satisfaction. Believe it or not. You know, things aren't feeling unsatisfactory because you haven't improved yourself enough, you know, using all these great self-improvement tools that are out there. It's just the way things are. At some level, at some point in time, life's going to feel like there's some discontentedness, there's some underlying dissatisfaction. Sure, there's real suffering out there. And you've probably noticed, if you've been coming here for a while, there's a couple folks living right there. No roof over their head. You know, they got two walls on the side, so maybe it helps with the wind. But they're living right there. That's suffering, you know? And that's the reality for so many people in this world. But that's not to minimize, you know, the existential suffering of realizing that we're born, we're going to die, what do we do with the time in between? That's very real. But just know it's not your fault. It's not your fault that life is unsatisfactory. That life at times feels unsatisfactory. We want to stay away from that translation that life is suffering. That's not what the Buddha was saying. So as Kamala Master said at her retreat on Saturday, the Pali is dukkha saccha. Dukkha meaning discontentedness, suffering, and then saccha meaning truth. So the truth is that there is discontentedness, unsatisfactoriness in the world. So all of these three characteristics involve uncertainty, just the impermanence of everything, the out-of-controlness of it, and the lack of satisfaction that we might feel with life. So why is uncertainty so uncomfortable? We sometimes mistake refuge for unassailable security. And one of the best illustrations I've heard of this is the difference between riding a tricycle and riding a bicycle. So you sit in a tricycle, and especially when it's not moving, you feel very secure. It's a stable tripod, right? You start riding a thing, as long as you're going in a straight line, it's really stable. Try going around a corner at high speed on a tricycle. That stability that you were relying on, all of a sudden, is a deficit. The fact that that thing was made to be stable when it's not moving means that it's less stable when it's in motion. A bicycle, on the other hand, feels very unstable when it's stopped. I'm always amazed at these people that can stop at a stop sign and turn the handlebars and shift their feet a little bit and sit there the whole 2 minutes that the light is on red and then take off again when it goes. I can't do that. But when a bike is stopped, it's not very stable. When it's moving in dynamic, like life, it's much more stable than a tricycle going around corners. So this dynamic, we talk in here about the ability of the mind to just concentrate on one thing and stay there versus the ability of the mind to move around as experience arises and move from one thing to another and pay attention to it. We call that dynamic awareness, the ability of the mind to actually move from one thing to another. This is valuable to be able to hold the mind on a single object for a while. It calms and stabilizes the mind, but it doesn't bring insight, because insight comes about through uncertainty. It comes about because of impermanence. It comes about because of the out of control nature of reality. If things were just completely 100% static and stagnant, we wouldn't learn anything. There would be no opportunity for insight. So this uncertainty feels uncomfortable because we all want to be, I don't know about you, but I want to be sitting on the tricycle, in the backyard with the sun shining, not needing to go anywhere. The reality is we've got to move around in life, right? And when we're moving around, we've got to rely on something that can adapt to shifting conditions like a bicycle. It can go around a corner at high speed when necessary and not tip over. This search for stability, it takes a lot of different forms. One of my own is that I had this self-image, this self-image as the one who knows. I've always liked that. I've always liked to be the person that knew things. I remember once I had a teacher was teaching me some concept in arithmetic. I think I was in like third or fourth grade. And when I got it, I actually started laughing. It was so joyful to learn this new operation in math, in arithmetic. It was simple arithmetic. So just knowing things just makes me happy. But having a self-concept as the one who knows keeps me from learning. So I've actually had to adopt a practice of I don't know. I mean, I've purposely taken on as a practice looking for opportunities to say, I don't know, and mean it. So I mentioned Suzuki Roshi's quote earlier, in the beginner's mind there are many possibilities, but in the expert's mind there are few. The beginning of that quote is, if your mind is empty, it is always ready for anything. It is open to everything. So that again emphasizes the dynamic nature of the practice, that we need to be, I mean, calm and stability and all that are great, and they serve us in a way, but this idea of being open to everything in our own experience, much less in the outer world, is really what the practice is about. It's about having a mind that's flexible enough to take on whatever comes along, even if it's not something that we signed up for. I mean, how many of you in the past week had something show up in your life that you didn't sign up for and that you maybe wouldn't have even wanted if given the choice? Which you were not, because things are out of control. If your mind is empty, it is always ready for anything. It is open to everything. So, again, maintaining this beginner's mind is what keeps our practice fresh. Uncertainty and ambiguity in this context means not needing things in a certain way. You don't have to have the hall completely quiet to be able to meditate for 45 minutes, which is what you all did just a few minutes ago. It's meditated for 45 minutes. You don't need the body to be 100% comfortable to stay aware. And as our practice matures, we need to be willing to move into unfamiliar territory. You know, again, it wouldn't be an insight if you already knew it. So by definition, having an insight is taking us into unfamiliar territory. And the only way to do that is with a dynamic awareness that's willing to deal with a little bit of uncertainty. One of my favorite poems is from Rainer Maria Rilke's Book of Hours, and there's a line in there. He says, I am circling around God, around the ancient tower, and I have been circling for 1,000 years, and I still don't know if I'm a falcon or a storm or a great song. So he's been circling for 1,000 years. He still doesn't know if he's a falcon, a storm, or a great song. Now, does it matter? All three of those are incredible achievements of great beauty. So he's circling around this ancient tower, and he doesn't know. He's been doing it for 1,000 years. He doesn't seem to be upset about that. He seems to be okay with that ambiguity, circling the ancient tower and not understanding if he's a falcon, storm, or a song. There's a self-help blogger from Singapore named Celestine Chua. Any of you know her? The only reason her name came up is I did a search for quotes on uncertainty. She came up and I liked her stuff. She says, fear, uncertainty, and discomfort are your compasses toward growth. Your compasses, they're what point you toward growth. Fear, uncertainty, and discomfort. Now, fear can also be, well, so can discomfort and uncertainty. They can become overwhelming at a certain level. So I'm using uncertainty in a real specific context here in this talk about using it as a skillful means in meditation. But she says, fear, uncertainty, and discomfort are your compasses toward growth. I like that. They're the things that point you toward growth because they point you toward change. So let's take some examples. We're in formal meditation, and we sense an emotion arising and manifesting in the body. So we don't need a precise label for that. You don't need to know if it's a falcon or a storm or a song. You don't need to know if it's irritation versus annoyance. Now, it's probably helpful to know if it's irritation or full-blown rage. You know, we ought to have that level of discernment where we can tell irritation from full-blown rage. But I think sometimes when we encourage folks to pay attention and maybe even note, you know, emotions and thoughts as they're arising in the body, the tendency is to want to be super precise, which is great with practice, but just understand that this idea of uncertainty really gives us permission. I mean, you're the only one that's going to hear these thoughts anyway, right? So if you're making a note of some uncomfortable sensation in the body and some associated emotion and it's manifesting somewhere in the body, if you can get close to the territory of it to be able to know, well, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of irritation and annoyance, stop there. Don't spend a whole bunch of time, you know, analyzing, well, is that irritation or annoyance? Well, you know, and she said that, and then I said that, and you know, then you're on the hamster wheel of papancha, you know, the perseverating thoughts. They're just going to cause more suffering. But be able to get in the approximate territory, you know. You need to be able to discern what's going on. In other words, we should be able to feel the difference between annoyance and rage without having the exact words. Just be able to know what general territory we're in. I've found in daily life, it really helps to learn how to hold an open question. So sometimes when a difficult situation arises, our tendency, because we want that tricycle, we want that stability, our tendency is just to grab a quick answer, even if it's not the right one, just so that we don't have to think about it anymore, so that we can have the comfort of having an answer, any answer. You know, you've probably heard the humorous book title, Don't Just Do Something, Sit There. No, it's a book about meditation. Don't just do something, sit there. Because just doing something is the unskillful response that we have when something arises in our life that we're not comfortable with. And the tendency when you do something like that is you're just relying on old habit. The response, if you try to do an instant, quick answer for something, is going to be coming out of your old habits. It's not going to be coming out of some new, fresh insight that's happening because you have a beginner's mind. So it's really helpful to hold these open questions. My wife, life partner Mary, and I are dealing right now with her parents. I'm sure many of you are dealing with your parents, the ones that are lucky enough to still have them alive. And so the question arises, so they're in independent living, the question arises, when is it time to go to assisted living? So you could take that question, independent versus assisted. They're already in a home that has multiple levels, so that's not the issue of moving them. Luckily, they made the decision to move out of their home on their own, for which we're very thankful. But so you have this question, moving from independent to assisted. So, you know, you go to the experts, and they have this big, huge, long laundry list of all the things you should be looking at in making that decision. You can't make that decision in a moment, the minute the question arises. There are so many aspects to it. Can they monitor the medication? Can they walk? Can they bathe themselves? Can they get dressed? Can they get themselves down to the dining room for meals? You know, there's this whole long list of questions. The only way to answer those is to just leave the question open, not making up your mind, holding the beginner's mind, and then being with them over a period of time. And that's That's what she's doing. She's going down there tomorrow, spend a couple more days with them, see what's going on. And there are so many questions like this in our lives that come up, and our immediate instinct is just, oh, I got to solve that. You know, this is a results-oriented culture, and it's like, bam, you know, I need to get an answer to that right away, or I'm going to be seen as indecisive. I need to, you know, jump on that right now and have a decision. Well, you know, there's so many questions in life that benefit from just letting the question sit there, not even having it in the front of the mind, just letting it kind of fade to the background, kind of be there quietly, and then we go about our business. I mean, how often have you struggled with something, even if it's just remembering a word and a crossword, you know, and you're struggling with it, and, oh, what was the capital of ancient Mesopotamia, you know, and then you go off and do something completely different, you know, and you're off cooking spaghetti and the answer comes in, you know, and someone had said, well, if you want to know the answer to what was the capital of ancient Mesopotamia, go cook spaghetti. You'd think they were crazy. But it's because that question was there, not in the foreground, fitted to the background, still working. This mind, this human mind is amazing. Still working in the background, and then kind of as things come in, it's like I picture my little gatekeeper going, relevant, irrelevant, relevant, irrelevant, relevant, relevant, irrelevant, irrelevant. You know, everything that comes through is touching that question and then just leaving it. Not pressing on it, you know, not sort of grabbing it by the throat and shaking it, but just touching on it and then going away. And over time, the answer emerges. Just like in our practice, insights emerge over time. You know, this is a gradual training, right? We don't believe in Satori in this particular tradition. We don't believe that there's this moment of lightning when you go from completely ignorant to completely enlightened. It's just not how it works. It's a gradual training. We gradually take on things. Our somehow this mind-body process kind of knows when we're ready for certain things and kind of lets them come in when we're ready for them and not before. I have no idea how that works, but I believe that it does. And, you know, I think of the example also came up this weekend where you've heard the same instruction 20 times and all of a sudden on number 21, you know, you get it. Well, it's because of the other 20 times, the experiences around that and how those sat in your life at that time. You can't just hear it on the 21st time, and, you know, without hearing the first 20. That's just the way it is. So conditions set up, they interact, and holding an open question in your life is a really great way of using uncertainty for positive benefit in your daily life. Pema Chodron, who's great around all this stuff, she has a book over 10 years old called Comfortable with Uncertainty. 108 teachings on cultivating fearlessness and compassion. And we'll get to that compassion thing in a bit. It's not impermanence per se, or even knowing we're going to die, that is the cause of our suffering, the Buddha taught. Rather, it's our resistance to the fundamental uncertainty of our situation. It's not the uncertainty. It's our resistance to the fundamental uncertainty of our situation. Our discomfort arises from all our efforts to put ground under our feet, to put a nice, smooth, concrete pavement underneath our tricycle, to put ground under our feet to realize our dream of constant okayness. Okay? That's just great. It's not impermanence per se, or even knowing we're going to die, that is the cause of our suffering, the Buddha taught. Rather, it's our resistance to the fundamental uncertainty of our situation. Our discomfort arises from all our efforts to put ground under our feet to realize our dream of constant okayness. Now, I don't know about you, but I want more out of life than constant okayness. That's the other end of this whole uncertainty thing, is that, you know, you can be in this sort of Thorazine, you know, slightly awake state of a little bit of pleasant all the time. And, okay, maybe you won't have really, really deep suffering, but you're not going to ever have any high highs either. That's what we keep saying in this practice. We don't expect you to just have a flat line, you know, brain scan. That actually we expect that when we embrace life, we actually become more involved in it, more engaged, so that we're able to be in a dynamic situation and take on things that are difficult if we need to. That for me, that's a connection that she makes, even in just the title of her book, in her brilliant way, between uncertainty, being uncomfortable with uncertainty, and compassion. Because the only way we're going to be able to be compassionate with someone else's suffering is if we're comfortable with uncertainty. You know, it's hard enough to understand our own suffering. To understand someone else's suffering, to me, almost by definition, requires a comfort with uncertainty. Because when you're brave enough to take that opening of heart to someone else's suffering, you're taking on territory that by definition is not your own. It's not your own territory. It's not something that you're 100% familiar with. So we see that this whole area of uncertainty, when it hasn't leaked over into doubt, and I'll get to doubt in a second, actually has great promise for our practice to open up our lives to greater things. So let's distinguish now uncertainty from doubt. The fifth hindrance, you know, there are five traditional hindrances to meditation, to mindfulness. Desire, aversion, restlessness and worry, sloth and torpor. The fifth one is doubt. And doubt is the most insidious, because when doubt is present, we don't want to practice. You know, the other ones, we keep practicing, they aren't real comfortable. In fact, some things like desire, we're having a great time. You know, we're going along, and when we should be meditating, we're fantasizing about our next vacation to Hawaii, or that's my deal. Fantasizing about our next vacation to Hawaii or whatever. Very pleasant. But doubt completely takes away the ability to practice, because we're doubting either the Buddha, the Dhamma, or the Sangha. In this tradition, doubt specifically means doubts about either the historical Buddha and what he taught, or the internalized potential in ourselves to awaken, right? So, there's two levels of all. Jack Kornfield says there's two levels to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. So the Buddha is the historical Buddha, or when you turn it inward, it's the ability that we have, each of us, to awaken, which, you know, bodhicitta or Buddha nature. We doubt that. We doubt that we can actually awaken. That's insidious. Doubt in the Dhamma, doubt in the teachings, and that could take many different forms. It might be, well, what's the relevance of this stuff that was taught 2,600 years ago in a culture that's foreign to me, in a caste system that I totally reject? Why should I believe any of that? Or how's that relevant to today? You know, it can take that form. Doubt in the teaching, doubt in the Dhamma. And then doubt in the Sangha. Oh, maybe this isn't right for me. All these people, they talk too much. Maybe I should try Tibetan practice for a while. Maybe I should try Zen practice for a while. Oh, I heard that diamond approach is really cool. I once met a teacher that really liked it. I think I'll try that for a while. You know, this flitting of the mind that you get with doubt. So, you know, uncertainty, with time, being with uncertainty, being with this practice, allows us to be with uncertainty and ambiguity to a greater and greater degree. But when it gets to the point of doubt, of, you know, one of the illustrations the Buddha used is a fish flopping around, you know, when a lake dries up, you're probably all seeing these rivers that are finally coming down, and you've probably read they're exposing fish that had gotten off into channels that haven't been channeled since 1997. And so now, you know, the water's going away and these fish are left. And the water's going away. You can imagine if you're getting your oxygen from water and all of a sudden you're in the air. And when they do that, they flop around. And that's doubt. You're flopping around. You're so uncomfortable that you're just flopping around and you're not able to settle at all. That's not healthy. That's not what we're talking about with uncertainty. Doubt colors our perception of the teachings and it clouds the mind to our experience. It's characterized by indecision, that's that flopping around, lack of confidence in either ourselves or the teachings, and rampant thinking. So Joseph says that doubt masquerades as wisdom. Because it's this rampant thinking. It's, oh, well, maybe I should be trying that practice. Maybe I should be trying that practice. Oh, well, you know, you're questioning your own ability. You're questioning the relevance of the teachings. You're questioning. Now, there's a certain kind of questioning doubt that's healthy in this practice. You know, we're taught that we need to test everything in our own experience and not just believe it because someone says it. That's fine. That kind of doubt is fine. But Gill calls the other kind hindering doubt. So doubt as a hindrance. It's when we're actually not even able to practice because we doubt the efficacy of the practice. Why should I do this? This is 2,600 years old. It's irrelevant to my life in the 21st century, etc. So that's the kind of doubt we want to avoid. So just a couple of suggestions on practicing with doubt. And of course, you know, first thing is to notice it, to actually be able to label it as doubt. Because one reason doubt is so insidious is that it does masquerade as wisdom, or it masquerades as questioning, or it masquerades as other things. We don't realize it's doubt. So just saying doubt, labeling it as doubt, and recognizing what doubt feels like in the body is really valuable. It can help dispel it. And just recognizing doubt as it occurs. So it's really, you know, mindfulness of the body is really helpful. Noticing that you're preoccupied in thoughts, concepts, and beliefs around questioning the practice and whether it's working for you or whether it's even worth thinking about. That's a sure sign that doubt's present. There's Gil Fronsdal has this great little volume about that thick called Unhindered, and it's about the hindrances. And there's a whole chapter on doubt, so a lot of these are coming from him. Get interested in what doubt feels like physically. So when doubt is present, first you have to be able to name it, right? Because otherwise you won't know it's present. There won't be any awareness around it. But once you're aware of it, try to see where it shows up in your body. Just as in the meditation, we were looking for where emotions show up in our bodies. Where does that actually show up? And get used to what it feels like, because then you'll be able to use it the next time it shows up. Since it is so insidious and it's hard to name, if you can learn where it shows up in your body, how it feels, is it a heaviness? Is it a cloak? Is it confusion? Is it fogginess? Just however it shows up for you in your body, get to know that. For minor doubts, Gil recommends just applying a little bit more discipline and resolve for your practice. So maybe making sure that you actually get on the cushion every day for a certain amount of time. You know, that level of discipline and resolve might be helpful. That's not going to work for major doubts. So he recommends just dealing with major doubts directly. So questioning deeply held beliefs, attending to unresolved feelings, or challenging ingrained convictions that may be causing you to lose faith in your own practice, in your own ability to practice. If your doubt involves uncertainty about the practice of the teaching, so in other words, doubt about the Dhamma, just find an opportunity to study or learn. Take a class. Or just talk to a teacher or a colleague about the Dhamma and what it means to you, and or ask them what it means to them. That can be helpful. Developing self-confidence. So that's why I had you at the end of the meditation. Try to think of one thing, maybe that one little benefit that might have come out of this one sitting. Because recalling the good like that can inspire faith. And faith is the far enemy of doubt. It's the opposite of it. So just developing self-confidence. And Gil says, you know, if you're just completely lost and not able to practice, don't say, well, you know, I'm going to be with my breath this whole sitting. You know, it's not going to work. So it's just going to increase your doubt. So what you do is you say, okay, I'm going to be with two breaths, two consecutive breaths. And if that works, try three. And if that works, try four. You know? And go from there. So small increments, just kind of titrating our ability to overcome the doubt, because it is very, very powerful. And then I love this line from Gill's book. He says, surprisingly, spending less time thinking about oneself can help confidence. This kind of gets to your thing. This is because self-preoccupation tends to undermine healthy self-regard. So we need healthy self-regard to be able to practice, to be able to have confidence in our ability to practice and confidence of the practice to work its magic on us. But we don't want that to flow over into overly absorbed self-preoccupation. And then finally, he says, it can be helpful to remember something that inspires you in the practice, which is the point of my little thing at the end there. So you might try that, you know, even if you're not having doubt, because you store these up like little jewels that you can access later. So every once in a while at the end of your sitting or at the end of your day, reflect on the good that you did during that day. An encounter you had with another person, someone that you helped, you know, someone that you didn't dump on when they said something mean to you, or, you know, somebody cut you off in traffic and you didn't honk your horn and scream at them. You know, even if you just refrain from something, find little things that you can reflect on that are positive. And then later in your practice, when doubt arises, which it will, doubt arises in many different forms. And as doubt is the first thing that goes away at the first stage of enlightenment. I don't know about you, but I'm not at the first stage of enlightenment yet. So it like many of the hindrances in our lives, the more we practice, the weaker and more subtle it gets, but it still shows up in a lot of different ways. So learn to have a storehouse of positive practice experiences that you can sort of recall intuitively, easily, when doubt does arise, because it will arise. Questions? Comments? Any expansion on your earlier question?
Sorry.
I just wanted to follow up with this one first, since it was on the floor.
And I apologize for interrupting you.
Oh, no problem. No interruption.
I think the challenge is it's easy to think back. Like when I shaved this morning, I was not perfectly conscious as I was shaving. It was habit, conditioning, and luckily I didn't come to the
Right.
It's at the moments when I'm most mindful that it seems like there is volition, because I'm aware of as much as I can be aware of internally and externally.
Right.
And I am then making a choice.
Yeah.
And if you were talking about the first stage of enlightenment, if seeing through self-view is part of the first stage, there's this paradox that's really hard to...
Right. So when you're being really mindful and it feels like I am making choices, what are you basing that choice on?
The totality of sense, experience, and whatever thought is coming to mind. So we have no control over that. Okay.
You have no control over the thought. The mind is a result of nature and nurture. You know, you got your genes from your parents. They had whatever background they had. That's informing your current decisions. Your value system. You know, you're making a decision based on your value system. I don't know many people that just pluck their value system off a shelf. You know, that comes from the community you've been raised in, from your family system. So that's all I'm trying to say.
No.
I'm not saying that there's not volition. I'm saying, of course there's volition. And that's a really important aspect of this practice, is making choices. But just not to get too attached around the concept that it is I that is making that decision. That decision is being made in the context of society, of your background, of your genes, of all kinds of things that, you know, to put it bluntly, they aren't you.
Yeah.
And acknowledge the reality of the relative self, you know, as the Buddha himself did. Yes, Ruth, you have some?
That's really depressing.
Just say more.
Well, I mean, to think that you don't really sort of have any control, that it all has to do with all of the other factors that are guiding or controlling your life, your family, you know, all of it.
Yeah. What do you find more enlivening?
Well, I would like to feel like some of the decisions, at least, that I'm making are really coming out of my adult life and things that I've learned.
They are. The decisions are, but all of the conditions around them aren't. I mean, I don't know about you. I'd be really depressed if I was personally responsible for the state of the world right now. You know? I mean, people drinking lead-filled water and people, you know, getting diseases from the air they're breathing and whatever. I could go on and on. I'm really glad I'm not personally responsible for all that. You know, I find it less depressing that just happens and it's not my fault. So.
I would just like to feel like I'm responsible for the things that I do, at least some of them.
You are.
You know.
That's a paradox of this whole question, is that we have huge responsibility for how we speak, how we act, you know, which thoughts we decide to latch on to, you know, the judgments of other people. I mean, they come instantly without our being able to control them. But if we believe them, you know, we can choose to believe them or not. So, yeah, we have great responsibility. It's not your fault. That shouldn't be depressing. I find that not depressing at all, that it's not my fault. Yes, Jay?
Just to piggyback on what Ruth and Jay were saying, I find it interesting that kind of coming from the relative mind, when you think about it in the way Ruth was saying, it's depressing. If you think about it, it is depressing. But if you're living it, it's not depressing. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be that there's this certain amount of flow that is experienced when you abide in the uncertainty. And another thing that came out when you were speaking about that topic was that uncertainty is truth, and that certainty, which we try to force upon our experience, is the untruth that causes our suffering.
That's right.
So it just seems to me that it seems counterintuitive to the thinking mind that to give up this this safe place is really the safest place to be.
Mm-hmm.
And one last thing that kind of popped into my mind is the Big Lebowski, the dude abides. And I always think the dude abides in uncertainty, mm-hmm. because there's all this stuff that's going on in his life, and he just kind of is like, well, this is what it is. And so when you were talking about uncertainty, that really popped up into my head.
Thank you for that.
Explore much doubt, so I'm not quite sure. So I have an example. When I am at a retreat, a daily retreat, and of course you come out very enlightened and very happy, and someone does something in the road, and suddenly all the rage comes. And you feel, oh my God, 10 minutes ago I was very peaceful and now I'm flipping someone off. So then I think, what happened? So I can feel there is a little bit of attachment to go back to the previous stage.
Right.
But is that doubt also? Mm-hmm. Because I'm questioning a little bit, okay, so where did the previous state go?
Right. Yeah. Well, no. I wouldn't call that doubt so much, especially when it's happened enough, when you have it happen a whole bunch of times. So it's what you described it exactly, actually. What it is, it's attachment to the peace and tranquility. So that's where this dynamic awareness comes in. Is it, you know, often a day long, we'll just settle into that peace and tranquility, and then when you leave, that's not there anymore. And so that's what happened to the Buddha, right? He went to these extremely exalted states of self-denial and really high concentration states and realized it wasn't mitigating his suffering. As soon as he got out in the world, he was miserable again. Well, I don't know about miserable, but less happy. So he realized that, hey, this isn't the end game, this ability to concentrate and bring peace and tranquility, and who knows what other states he was able to achieve. But the same thing applies to us when we have a day, we have a day long, we get 5 or 6 hours of quiet and peace, and might be a beautiful Dharma talk like Kamala gave on Saturday. And then all of a sudden you're just thrown out into the world of people being inconsiderate and doing whatever they do. And so it's very natural to, first of all, you're walking out there with your heart open, because it takes a while for it to close back down again. So you're walking out there with your heart open. So in a way you're more vulnerable to the everyday nastiness of the world to begin with. And then yes, to the degree that you're attached to that quiet and tranquility and calm that you had for a few hours of respite. Saito Utejaniya talks about the pendulum. The wider the pendulum swung this way into peace and tranquility, the wider it's going to swing this way into irritation, annoyance, anger, rage. So it's the pendulum. So yeah, if you're so attached to that calm and tranquility and peace, then when it's gone and you're getting something you don't like, then yeah, you're going to have a equal but opposite reaction, as Newton said. So yeah, I wouldn't call that doubt. And then with time, when you've experienced that enough, you'll just recognize that is the way things are and it's not my fault. You know, if I get angry because somebody cuts me off 5 minutes after I was in a peaceful meditation, that's just the way things are. It's not my fault. Let's close with a brief recognition of the way things are, which is that there are many beings suffering on all kinds of different levels, and the extent this practice is actually working in our lives, it opens us up to that suffering. It doesn't close us off. So may we all develop the ability to live in uncertainty, to be comfortable in movement and change, and to open our hearts to the suffering of others, knowing that just like us, all beings want to be happy, and wishing from a deeply connected place and not a place of separation, may we and all beings be peaceful and happy, safe and protected, as healthy and strong as our current circumstances allow. And may we in some real way and all beings be free from suffering. practice.